This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is Lecture 2, given in Dornach on March 22, 1920. Our points of departure today will be similar to yesterday's, but we will move on and gradually delve further into the essential nature of the human being by observing certain polarities that govern it. You will recall from yesterday that in the case of the human being, the downward-directed forces predominating in animals were combined visually into a parallelogram with forces that act vertically. We also saw an analog of this in muscle activity. If we pursue these two ideas as we study the human skeleton and muscular system, enlisting the help of everything experience can provide at present, it should soon be possible to make the study of bones and muscles more significant for medicine than it has been thus far. If we take cardiology as our starting point today, however, the connection between knowledge of the human being and the needs of medicine becomes especially difficult. I could say that something present as a mere potential in the study of bones and muscles has emerged fully in the view that has developed with regard to cardiology. Let us restrict ourselves to the heart for the time being. And what is the general view of the human heart? It is seen as a pump of sorts, pumping the blood into the various organs. All kinds of interesting mechanical constructions have been invented in the attempt to explain the heart as a pumping machine. In reality, these mechanical constructions completely contradict embryology, but people have not been attentive enough to really question this mechanical theory of the heart, so it has not been tested, or at least not in the generally accepted scientific view. I will first sketch the situation for you, and what I present in the next few days will confirm, bit by bit, what I can initially present only as a point of view. The main thing to consider in looking at the heart is that the heart absolutely is not and cannot be a so-called active organ. The activity of the heart is not a cause, it is a consequence. You will understand this last statement only by bearing in mind the polarity that exists between the human organism's metabolic activities and its respiratory activities. Look at all the activities involved in taking in and processing nutrients and channeling them into the bloodstream, either directly or via the vessels. Here you trace the transformation of nutrients in the organism as they move upward from below. You trace this right up to the point of interaction between the blood, which has taken up the nutrients, and the respiratory process, which takes in air. If you take a very good look at the processes under consideration here, and all you really need to do is look at them properly, you will find a certain contrast between everything belonging to the respiratory process and everything belonging to the metabolic process in its broadest sense. These processes want to balance each other out. They are, quote-unquote, thirsting after each other, in a manner of speaking, longing to satisfy themselves with each other. Parenthesis, of course, other ways of expressing this could be chosen. However, as time goes on, we will understand each other better. Close parenthesis. Initially, liquefied nutrients interact with what is taken up by the organism in gaseous form through the respiratory process. This interaction must be studied precisely. It consists of forces that play into each other. But before doing so, they are dammed up in the heart. The heart comes about as a damming up organ between what I would now like to call the organism's lower activity, the intake and transformation of food, and its upper activities, of which I would consider respiration to be one of the lowest. A damming up organ is inserted between these activities. The most important point about this situation is that cardiac function is a consequence of the interaction between liquefied food and air taken in from outside. Everything that comes to expression in the heart, everything we can observe in the heart, must be considered a consequence. To begin with, we must even consider it a mechanical consequence. Footnote: in the most recent German edition, these last two sentences constitute a single sentence, which was altered after re-examining the stenographic record. End of footnote. The only promising attempt that has been made to reconsider at least this mechanical basis of cardiac function, but nothing more, was made by an Austrian physician, Dr. Carl Schmidt, from North Styria, who published a paper entitled Pulse Curves and the Beating of the Heart in the Vienna Medical Weekly, 1892, number 15 through 17. Although this treatise is somewhat short on content, an active medical practitioner has at least noticed that we must deal with the heart as if it were a damming up apparatus rather than an ordinary pump. To Schmidt, the beating motion of the heart resembles the action of a hydraulic ram, which is flow activated. Here, implicit in Dr. Schmidt's description, lies the actual truth of the matter. When we see all cardiac function as the consequence of these interpenetrating flows, as I can now symbolically term them, of fluid and of gas, we are still viewing matters only on the mechanical level. Footnote: this sentence has also been altered on the basis of the original stenographic record of the lecture. End of footnote. But ultimately, what is the heart? It is a sense organ. And ultimately, even if we are not directly conscious of the heart's sensory function, even though this is one of our subconscious sensory activities, the heart nonetheless exists so that our upper activities may sense and perceive our lower activities. Just as you perceive color processes in the environment with your eyes, you also perceive with your heart, although in the dimness of the subconscious. You perceive what is taking place in the lower part of your body. Ultimately, the heart is an organ of inner perception, and it must be addressed as such. We will understand the actual polarity within the human being only if we acknowledge that a human being is a dual being, built up in such a way that the lower portion is perceived by the upper portion. I must add the following, however. We can take the lower activities, that is, one pole of the total human being, as given if we study the intake of nutrients and their transformation in the wider sense, up to the point where they are balanced out against respiration. The balancing of nourishment with respiration takes place through our rhythmical activity, the significance of which we will still have to discuss. But we must see sensory and neural functions, everything related to outer perception, and how it is taken further and processed by neural activity, as being entwined with respiratory functions. If you add together these two things, respiratory activity and sensory neural activity, you have some notion of one pole of the human organization. On the other hand, if you add together the intake and transformation of nourishment, that is, metabolism in the ordinary sense of the word, you have the other pole in the human organization. Essentially, the heart is the organ whose perceptible movement expresses the balance between these upper and lower poles. On a psychological, or perhaps it would be better to say sub-psychological level, the heart acts as the organ of perception that mediates between these two poles of the human organization. You will see that only this principle, if kept in mind while studying everything that anatomy, physiology, and biology have to offer, is capable of shedding light on the human organization. As long as you do not differentiate between these upper and lower poles, with the heart mediating between them, you will be unable to understand the human being, because there is a fundamental difference between all of the lower organizational activity of the human being and the activity of the upper organization. If we want to express this contrast in a simple way, we might say something like this: everything taking place down below has its negative image or counterpart up above. We can always find a corresponding image in the lower region for everything that is involved in the upper region. The most significant point here, however, is that there is no material transfer of substance between the upper and the lower, but only a correspondence. We must always understand how to relate something from down below to something else up above, without insisting on a material transfer. Let us take a very simple example, the cough reflex and actual coughing, in the context of what is up above, or to the extent that these things belong up above. Their counterpart down below is diarrhea. We will always find that anything in the upper region has its counterpart below. We understand the human being correctly only when we are able to grasp these correspondences correctly, and we will encounter many of them in this lecture course. These are more than just abstract correspondences. At the same time, in any healthy organism, an intimate association is taking place between the upper and the lower. In a healthy organism, this association of pairs is such that any particular upper body function, perhaps a respiration-related activity, or one related to the sensory neural apparatus, must overcome another activity down below and run its course in complete harmony with this lower counterpart. An irregularity immediately occurs in the organism if a process from below somehow gains ascendancy or precedence, so that it is far too strong for its corresponding activity above, or vice versa. Parenthesis, later this will lead us to a true understanding of the disease process. Close parenthesis. Upper functions must always correspond to lower ones in a specific way, overcoming each other, taking place in ways that reflect their orientation toward each other, as it were. This orientation is very specific and is individually different in each person, but in every case there is a very specific correspondence between how upper processes and lower processes run their course. It is important to be able to make the transition from this healthily functioning organism, in which the upper and lower aspects are in correspondence, to a diseased organism. Let us begin with signs of disease in what Paracelsus calls the archaeus, and we call the etheric body. If you want to disguise it so that outsiders who want to know nothing of these things do not object, you could also say that you want to talk about the very first functional or dynamic signs of illness. If we begin with these, if we talk about what is disclosed first in the etheric body, or in the merely functional dimension, we can again speak of a polarity, but a polarity that encompasses the non-correspondence or irregularity. This comes about in the following way. Let us assume that down below, in food intake and in the digestive system in the broader sense, the inherent chemical and or organic forces of the ingested food predominate. In a healthy organism, all of these forces that are active and inherent in the food itself, all the forces we study externally in the laboratory, have to be overcome by the upper element to such an extent that they become irrelevant to any internal activity of the organism. No outer chemistry or outer dynamics or the like continues to function. It is all completely overcome. It can happen, however, that the correspondence is not strong enough for the upper element to really grasp and pervade its lower counterpart completely. In a sense, the upper element cannot completely cook the lower, or, as I might also put it, etherize it through and through, which would be a slightly more accurate description. In such a case, the process that predominates in the human organism really does not belong there. It is a process just like those taking place in the outer world, and it should not be taking place within the human organism. Because irregularities do not immediately engulf the physical human being, processes such as these first become evident in what could be described as the functional aspect in the etheric body, the archaeus. If we were to choose a colloquial expression derived solely from certain specific forms of this irregularity, we would have to choose the term hysteria. In fact, as we shall see later, this is not a bad choice. So we will use hysteria as an expression or technical term for excessive independence of the metabolic processes. Actual symptoms of hysteria, in the narrower sense, are nothing but metabolic irregularity driven to a climax state. In reality, even hysterical processes that have reached the stage of sexual symptomatology are nothing more than such metabolic irregularities, which by nature are outer processes that should not be present within the human organism, lower processes that the upper processes are too weak to overcome. This is one of the two poles. Whenever such symptoms of hysteria appear, we are dealing with an excessively strong, non-human, or extra-human activity in the lower parts of the human organization. But the same irregularity in the interaction between upper and lower can also occur because an upper process fails to run its proper course, taking place in a way that is too demanding on the upper organization. This is the opposite, the negative image of the lower process. It demands too much of the upper organization. It reaches its conclusion before it connects with the lower organism via the heart. It is too strongly spiritual, too strongly intellectual on an organic level, if I may use that expression. In such cases, the other one of these polar irregularities appears, namely neurasthenia. Above all else, it is important to look at these two irregularities of the human organism, irregularities that lie within the functional sphere, since these are the defects that express themselves above and below. We will, gradually, have to understand how the polarity in the human organization succumbs to one or the other of these deficits. In neurasthenia, we have an upper function that demands too much of the upper organs. As a result, something that should have been transmitted from above via the heart, in order to take place down below, instead takes place prematurely up above and reaches its conclusion there. The activity in question is not transmitted through the damming up process in the heart, and thus does not extend down into the lower flow, the flow of liquefied nutrients. You can also see that it is more important, far more important, I might say, to study a syndrome's outer manifestations than to study defective organs post-mortem. An autopsy of defective organs merely reveals consequences. The essential thing is to grasp the overall picture, the phenomenon of the illness, which in some way will always tend more in one direction or the other, toward neurasthenia or hysteria. Parenthesis, of course, we have to stretch the usual meanings of these terms. Close parenthesis. Once we have pictured the collaboration between upper and lower clearly enough to take it as our starting point, we will gradually come to recognize how something that is initially apparent only as a functional element taking place in the etheric, as we would say, is then able to take hold of the organic physical element by becoming denser in its forces. At that point, it can be said that what was initially present as a mere suggestion of hysteria is then able to assume physical form in various abdominal diseases. Similarly, in the other direction, neurasthenia assumes an organic form in diseases of the throat and head. For the medicine of the future, it will be extremely important to study these imprints of what are initially functional, physical symptoms in neurasthenia and hysteria. The consequence of hysteria that has become organic, if I may put it this way, will be irregularities occurring anywhere in the digestive system or in abdominal processes in general. But what takes place in one such system of organs works back into the organism as a whole. We must not ignore the fact that irregularities occurring here work back on the entire organism. Imagine it like this. Something that would simply be an hysterical symptom if it initially appeared on the functional level fails to come to any kind of functional expression at all. It is absolutely possible for it never to be expressed on the functional level. Instead, the etheric body immediately forces it into the physical body, where it is present within the abdominal organs, although it does not appear there as any definite illness. We might say the abdominal organs are imprinted with a stamp of hysteria. Because this tendency is imprinted on the physical element, it does not come to expression on the psychological level as a symptom of hysteria, but neither is it strong enough to be a troublesome physical illness. It is strong enough, however, to influence the entire organism. Now we have the peculiar phenomenon of something that hovers between disease and health and works upward from below. It works back on what is up above, infects the upper aspect, and appears in the form of its negative image. The first physical consequence of hysteria appears in parts of the body that would usually be subject to neurasthenia if they became unbalanced and irregular. This phenomenon predisposes the person in question to tuberculosis. This is an interesting connection. Predisposition to tuberculosis is a consequence of the activity that was just described as working back on the upper parts of the body from below. This very extraordinary interaction comes about because an unfinished process, as I described it, works on the upper part of the body. This gives rise to a predisposition to tuberculosis. It will prove impossible to discover any rational means of dealing with tuberculosis without going back to this archetypal tendency of the human organism, as I would like to call it. That parasites gain ground within the human organism is simply a consequence of the archetypal tendencies I have just described. This does not contradict the fact that given the necessary prerequisites, an illness such as tuberculosis is contagious. Of course, the necessary prerequisites must be present. But unfortunately, this predominance of lower body organic activity occurs in a terribly high percentage of the population today. So predisposition to tuberculosis is frighteningly widespread. Contagion is still a valid concept here, however, because people who are gravely ill with tuberculosis do affect their fellow human beings, and exposure to a tubercular patient's environment can indeed make it possible for what is otherwise a mere consequence to once again become a cause. I always attempt to use an analogy or comparison to clarify this relationship between the primary genesis of a disease and contagion. Let us assume I meet a friend in the street whose personal relationships normally do not concern me. This friend is sad, and with good reason, because one of his friends has died. I have no direct connection to the deceased person, but upon meeting my friend and hearing about his grief, I begin to feel sad with him. His sadness, however, is due to a direct cause, while mine is due to contagion. But it remains true that only the relationship between myself and my friend supplies the necessary prerequisite for this contagion. In this way, concepts of primary occurrence and contagion are both fully justified, especially with regard to tuberculosis. These concepts, however, really need to be applied rationally. Tuberculosis sanatoriums are sometimes actual breeding grounds for tuberculosis. If tubercular patients have to be crammed together in sanatoriums, then at least these buildings should be torn down periodically and replaced with new ones whenever possible. After a certain length of time, tuberculosis sanatoriums always ought to be replaced. The strange thing about it is that tubercular patients themselves have the greatest predisposition to infection, which means that otherwise curable patients with the illness may become worse if they are in the proximity of those who are more seriously ill. For the present, however, my intention is simply to indicate the nature of tuberculosis. This disease is a particularly good example of how the different processes in the human organism need to interweave. As you can imagine, these processes are inevitably influenced by the fact that we are dealing with an upper and a lower organization whose correspondence is like that of a positive image and its negative. If we study the further course of the most obvious symptoms that pave the way for tuberculosis, namely the presence of a bodily constitution such as I have described, these symptoms can serve as an example of how we should view the nature of illness in general. Consider the typical symptomatology of a person with incipient tuberculosis. Perhaps we will observe that this person is coughing and has a sore throat, chest pains, or pains in the limbs. We will note that the person suffers from fatigue, and night sweats will also be especially evident. Well, what is all this? If we investigate these symptoms, what are they really? Each of them is a result, at least initially, of the irregular inner interactions described earlier. But at the same time, each symptom also represents the organism's battle against the underlying deeper foundations of the illness. Let us look first at simple things like coughing. We will get to the more complex issues soon enough. You see, coughing should not always be suppressed, regardless of the circumstances. That is certainly not a good idea. Sometimes the organism may even need artificial stimulation to induce coughing. When a person's lower organization is such that it cannot be controlled by the upper organization, the cough reflex is a healthy reaction on the part of the body, an attempt to prevent certain things from getting in. Simply preventing coughing by direct means under any and all circumstances, may cause damage, because harmful factors will then be able to enter. The body coughs because in its present condition it cannot tolerate these harmful factors and wants to eliminate them. The cough reflex is just a sign of something happening in the organism that makes it necessary to prevent the entry of invaders that could otherwise easily gain access. But the other symptoms we mentioned are also a defense, the body's fight against incipient tuberculosis. Sore throat and limb pain simply indicate that the organism will not permit the occurrence of lower processes that cannot be controlled from above. Again, if the predisposition to tuberculosis is recognized in time, it might be a good idea, for example, to support the organism by provoking moderate coughing, and especially by inducing fatigue. Parenthesis, in subsequent lectures, we will see how this can be done. It can also be accomplished through certain dietary measures. Close parentheses. And if weight loss occurs, for example, this too is only a means of defense, because the process that takes place if weight loss does not occur may be the specific lower process that cannot be controlled from above in this case. In other words, the body is defending itself by losing weight, so that this uncontrollable factor is simply absent for the time being. It is therefore extremely important to study such issues in detail, rather than simply trying to fatten up someone who is losing weight without giving any further thought to the matter. There may be a very good reason for this person's weight loss in the context of what is being expressed in the organism at the time. Night sweats are particularly instructive in the case of a person who does not yet have tuberculosis, but is predisposed to the illness. These night sweats are nothing less than a bodily activity that takes place during sleep, when it should take place during waking hours, and when the person is fully spiritually and physically active. Something that ought to happen by day in full wakefulness does not take place then, but comes to expression during the night. It is, simultaneously, a consequence and a defense. While relieved of its spiritual activity, the organism creates the activity that comes to expression in night sweats. In order to do full justice to this subject, we must know a bit about the intimate connection between all excretory functions, including sweat formation, and the aspect of our nature that includes psychological and spiritual activity. Building up processes, the vital anabolic processes, really constitute only a basis for the unconscious, while excretory processes, wherever they may take place, correspond to the awake and conscious activities of the ensouled organism. Our thinking too corresponds to the brain's excretory or catabolic processes rather than to its anabolic processes. Night sweats constitute an excretory process that normally ought to parallel an activity of the soul and spirit. But because the upper part of the body is not interacting with the lower in the right way, this process waits until night, when the organism is freed from activity of spirit and soul. So you can see how a careful study of all the processes that are connected with the overall growth and development of the human organism, be it well or ill, leads to the conclusion that interaction between disease symptoms also occurs. Weight loss is, first of all, a sign of disease. But weight loss is something that is appropriate in the context of incipient or early-stage tuberculosis. The symptoms of an illness are united in a functional structure, a non-material organization, as it were. In a certain sense, one symptom belongs with another. As a result, if other conditions in the organism ought to provoke some sort of reaction, let us stick to incipient tuberculosis here. But the organism itself does not have the strength to accomplish this, then the rational thing to do is to assist the reaction just at that point, causing one illness to follow on another. Ancient physicians stated this as an important rule in the education of physicians. They said that the danger in being a physician lies in being able to induce illness as well as drive it away. Physicians are able to induce illnesses to the same extent that they are able to cure them. Thus the ancients, who knew more about such connections because of their atavistic clairvoyance, realized that a malicious physician would be able to make people not only well, but also ill. This ability to induce illness maliciously, however, is related to the need to induce certain disease states in order to bring them into the correct relationship with other disease states. But these induced disease states are illnesses in their own right, and coughing, sore throat, chest pain, weight loss, night sweats, all of these are real symptoms of illness. It may be necessary to induce them, but they remain real symptoms nonetheless. Of course, it is easy to realize that having half cured a person, that is, having induced these symptoms, we cannot simply abandon the patient to his or her fate. At this point, the second part of the healing process must set in. We must take care not to stop with inducing reactions to ward off the disease. Something must then ensue that cures these reactions and sets the whole organism back on the right track. We would have to ensure, for instance, that when coughing or a sore throat either develops naturally or is artificially induced as a defense against incipient tuberculosis, the digestive process, which in such cases always shows signs of constipation, is set straight. In one way or another, we will notice that this digestive process needs to be guided in the direction of an elimination process, diarrhea, for example. It is always necessary to allow diarrheal processes to follow coughing symptoms, sore throats, and the like. This points to the fact that a symptom appearing in the upper part of the body must not be seen in isolation. We must often look to lower body processes to cure upper body symptoms, even though there is no material connection between them, but only a correspondence. This is a prime consideration. When the metabolism is not controlled from above, severe symptoms of fatigue set in. I would not call these merely subjective symptoms. They are symptoms wholly determined organically and always based on a preponderance of the metabolism. Such symptoms of fatigue really do need to be induced in the tuberculosis patient, but they would have to be counteracted later at the appropriate time by means of a special diet, the details of which we will still have to discuss, so that digestion predominates in such a way that the patient digests food better than normal, and nutrients are more easily assimilated through digestion. Weight loss will later have to be counteracted through a diet leading to the disposition of fat formation in the organs and their tissues. We will have to deal with the induced night sweats by steering our patients toward an activity in which fully conscious, spiritualized exertion makes them sweat, so that they settle back into a healthy sweat formation process. You see, once a real understanding of cardiac function enables us to grasp correspondences between the upper and lower parts of the human being, And once we also understand the first signs of disease on the functional or etheric level, as in neurasthenia and hysteria, we can then move on to an understanding of their imprints on the organic and physical level. By studying the outer manifestations of symptoms that belong together, including symptoms we ourselves have induced, we will discover how to guide the course of an illness in a certain direction, deflecting it to a greater or lesser extent, in order to lead the entire process back toward health at the right moment. Of course, social considerations are the greatest impediment to the type of treatment I have begun to describe here. That is why medicine is definitely also a social issue. The patients themselves often present the greatest obstacles because they naturally insist that we, quote, get rid, close quote, of their illness, as they put it. But if we immediately get rid of it, they may easily become even sicker than they were before. We must also consider the possibility that we will make them much sicker than before, and that they will then have to wait until we are in a position to make them well again. By then, most of them, as I'm sure many of you will confirm, will probably have taken to their heels. Correctly observing the human being in sickness and in health makes it imperative for the physician to have control over the post-treatment period as well, if the entire course of therapy is to be as effective as it should be. We will simply have to agitate publicly for such things. In our age, with all its faith in authority, it should not be difficult to make people aware of essential factors like this, if only the appropriate popular movements can be set in motion. Of course, it is not always only the patients or social considerations that make it inconvenient to see an illness through to its conclusion. Excuse me for saying this in your presence, but sometimes this is the fault of physicians, who are more or less satisfied with having gotten rid of an illness. You will see that accurately elaborating on the heart's role in the human organism gradually leads us to the essential nature of illness. You will need to consider, however, the radical contrast that exists between the functions of the lower and upper parts of the body. Although the lower functions have certainly overcome mere external chemical activity in a certain respect, in some ways they also still resemble the upper functions, which are their complete opposites. It is extremely difficult to adequately define this duality within the human organism, because our language has almost no means of alluding to factors that counteract physical and organic processes. Perhaps you will understand me well enough for the time being. And I do not shy away from the prospect of encountering one bias or another in any of you, if I attempt an analogy to clarify the character of this dualism between upper and lower processes. If you call to mind the properties of any substance, the properties that make its effect apparent to us in any way, you have what is absorbed into the human being's lower functions once it has been overcome by the organism, as happens in digestion. It is also possible, however, to homeopathize substances, if I may put it like that, to eliminate the substance's internal cohesiveness. This happens when we dilute the substance in any way or prepare homeopathic doses. The resulting phenomenon has in no way been given due consideration by our modern science, and in any case people tend to consider everything abstractly. Thus light is said to spread out in all directions from its source, the sun, for example, until it vanishes into infinity. But this is not true. No such activity ever vanishes into infinity. Instead, it goes only as far as the limits of a definite sphere, and then snaps back on itself as if it were elastic. Admittedly, however, its qualitative aspect is then often different from the quality of the original outgoing force. Only rhythmical processes exist in the natural world. There are no processes that lose themselves in infinity. There are only processes that rebound on themselves in a rhythmic way. This is true of both quantitative and qualitative expansion. When you begin dividing a substance, it possesses certain properties from the outset. These properties do not decrease into infinity as you continue the divisions. Beyond a certain point, they swing back and turn into the opposite properties. This inner rhythm is also the basis of the contrast between our lower organization and our upper organization. Our upper organization is a homeopathizer. In a certain way, it immediately counteracts the ordinary digestive processes, forming their opposite, their negative image. It could be said that when homeopathic pharmacists produce their dilutions, they are really transforming properties that otherwise relate to the lower human organization into properties that then relate to the upper human organization. This is a very interesting inner connection, and we will have more to say about it in the next few days. The end of Lecture 2.